the applicability of Jewish law to contemporary society. Rabbi Berman was ordained at Yeshiva University, from which he also earned his BA. Dr. Chaya Gerstmann, clinical associate professor, is the early childhood coordinator of education department at Stern College for Women. Her focus is on teacher education and curriculum studies. Her interest in gender and Jewish education has prompted her to direct and co-author a Jehovah curriculum project on the study of matriarchs as strong women who directed and changed the course of Jewish history. After publishing several articles on gender in Jewish day schools, she and her co-author wrote a book called Selim Elohim, Gender Issues in Jewish Day Schools, which will be published in the fall of 2013 by Hadassah Brandeis in the Midwest. Rabbi Omid teaches the level class in Stern and is the Rav of Young Israel Flatbush. He is heavily involved with the American USA program and as a senior lecturer. Rabbi Omid is Talmud of the Rav and graduated from Hawaii. Nechama Price has been on faculty at Stern College in the Bible and Judaic Studies departments for the past 8 years. Prior to teaching at Stern, she completed the Stern College graduate program for advanced Talmudic studies, received an MS in Jewish education from Azrael Graduate School, and an MA in Bible from the Bernard Rebel Graduate School. She was the Shoal Leadership at the Stern Beit Midrash for 4 years. Currently, she is learning in Nishmat Yoetzet Halakha program. She lives in Burningfield, New Jersey with her husband and 3 children. Okay, those are our speakers. Thank you so much, everybody. Tonight's event, Feminism and Halakha, will feature questions which we collect from the Stern student body. From both student bodies. With humility and a deep belief that Torah is MS, we ask the following questions. We ask questions in the hope of preserving sanctity of Torah while simultaneously embracing the modernity that permeates our lives. There are no agendas behind these questions. There are no right answers. There is only the honest sharing of concerns, questions, and hope. We seek productive conversations and creative solutions, all the while respecting and valuing the institutional law. Question number one. Praying with a minyan leaves many women feeling like spectators at a sport. Are there halakhically sound avenues to including them more actively in a minyan? Are women prayer groups actually an effective solution, or are they halakhically limited? Would you encourage women prayer groups, better inclusion of women in a minyan, or something entirely? How and why?
So of the 5 questions, this one really made me sad. It made me sad because I think there's a fundamental sort of misunderstanding that exists both amongst men and amongst women about the nature of minyan and the difference between sibur and minyan. When the Jewish community gathers to pray, it's the entire tzibur that prays. The minyan is the quorum that is necessary in order for us to say that an entire community is present. But once the quorum is present, every member of the tzibur is engaged in the same prayer. The exception, of course, is the exception of shliach tzibur. Shliach tzibur needs to be someone who essentially modeled on kahuna, needs to be someone who is himself eligible to be counted toward quorum, toward minyan. But you have to not think in terms of minyan, you have to think in terms of tzibur and the tefillah of tzibur. The critical questions to me in relation to this are questions of both structure and content. The structure questions are simple. Women have to be much more assertive and much more, you'll excuse the expression, aggressive about the physical structure of the synagogues in which they pray. Women should not pray in synagogues which marginalize women. Women should pray in synagogues in which the bima is in the middle, where women have equal access, as it were, to bima. Women should pray in synagogues where the mechitza does not marginalize them by its physical appearance and by its location. And women need to take a much more active role in determining not only the synagogue in which their family prays, but the synagogue in which they pray and in which they feel they can have a significant experience of Tfilat B'tzibur, not only as a participant in Tfilat HaTzibur, but as a person engaged in Tfilat B'tzibur. Second element is content, and that is you have to assure, even within that framework, that the rabbi addresses women and their spiritual needs.
I basically agree with everything that Rabbi Berman said. I would just add a few other points. In terms of the spectator sport, which I think is not such a good metaphor, but you know, most men are actually spectators in the shul in the same way, because I know, for example, in my shul, when you ask for a volunteer to daven for the amud, 90% of the people don't want to daven for the amud. You manage to schlep somebody up to daven for the amud. It's not like it's this big deal, you know, some kind of a fantastic thing to daven for the amud. I mean, it has to be done. It's something that has to be done. Fine, but the people who aren't doing it or are sitting there are not necessarily spectators. They're davening, and most of what we daven, everyone davens the same thing. Men or women basically daven the same davening in shul. So again, if it is because, as Rabbi Berman said, women feel that they're sitting too far away, those are things to do in the architecture of the shul that could be that in theory could be changed to accommodate women's feelings. But I think that there's another issue as well, and that is that in the United States is probably in many, I would say particularly in the United States, which is a relatively quote-unquote religious country, so the non-Jewish religions identify themselves by the quote-unquote church to which they're affiliated. And what is the primary mode of any kind of religious expression? It is attending a church on Sunday. I think that this transferred over and sort of infiltrated Judaism to the point where we associate Judaism with shuls. Now, shul, tefillah, it's a very important mitzvah, but it's one fraction of one mitzvah. And certainly davening in a shul is one fraction of one mitzvah. That's not what Judaism is all about. It's only shuls. There's the whole Torah that we have to observe. Coming to shul while being very important is not the be all and end all in Judaism. A person is ill and they don't go to shul, they can still be mekayim many mitzvahs at home and be quite observant in terms of mitzvahs. So to equate shul and what goes on in shul with Judaism, I think, is part of the issue. The question also discusses women's prayer groups. So let me just address that for a moment. I'm not a proponent of women's prayer groups, and I'm not a proponent because I think that it's barking up the wrong tree. For women to get together and do the kind of things, leave out everything that needs a tzibur, and then just do everything else. So what exactly is it accomplishing? Just this past Shabbos, there is a women's prayer group in Flatbush where I live, and just this past Shabbos, a woman was telling my wife, you know, that she started going to this prayer group, and she got to have Hagba, you know, like it's a novelty. I think what a lot of people like about it is the fact that it's a novelty. So my wife said to her, well, you know, we have a Tehillim group on Tuesday nights. Maybe you would like to come to the Tehillim group. She was not interested in that. Now, why? Why wouldn't she be interested in going to a Tehillim group? I mean, that's also a tremendous religious expression. What is wrong? Why would some women feel that they only want to do the things that men are doing and not other ways in which there could be ample medium for religious expression? Okay, I'll stop.
When I was a little girl, I went to Camp Beis Yaakov. In Camp Beis Yaakov, girls davened every morning together. I was a chazanit. I had an amazing opportunity to lead women in spiritual prayer. That was my youth. Then I came to shul as I got older, and I didn't hear one woman's voice. It was quiet. But I heard a lot of men. I heard men singing. I heard men leading tefillah. I heard men laning. not a woman's voice. And when I said Kaddish 4 years ago and heard my voice and people said Amen, not only was I moved, but it was the most meaningful experience for me in shul as a woman. And about the men who don't want to daven, they have a choice. A man who doesn't want to daven and be davening has a choice. I don't have that choice. In the terms of the spectator sport, I love to daven. I love the prayer. I love the commitment to tefillah on a daily basis. I feel connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So tefillah is much more important to me than any tehillim, because I connect to the words and I feel God's presence. And Beit Sibur, the way I did in Camp Beis Yaakov, it is such a powerful piece to me. I can't be a spectator. I want to be part of it, and I want to hear women's voices, whether in song or in leadership or in speech. I need my women folks around me. I want 100% participation, not 50%.
Happens to be, when I read the question, for a moment, I considered how beautiful the question was, in that the reality is that, let's say a few years from now where you are, and 10 years or something, most women don't daven anymore. The sad reality is that a lot of times after women finish college and then they start a family, they can't daven, or they have trouble davening for a period of time when they have babies and whatever, and then they just get out of the habit, and then they really just don't daven anymore. So the fact that here you're trying to struggle to figure out how to have a more spiritual daven and a more, you know, connection to your davening, I think that's very beautiful, and I hope you hold on to that so that in 10 years from now, you are still davening. Now, when it comes to women's tefillah groups and all that discussion, I have a very different experience than you do. I went to Minyan very often before my children came. I loved Minyan. I felt very connected in Minyan. And I think it's like, as Rabbi Berman pointed out, it depends on what type of shul you go to. On Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur this year, I had the seat right next to the chazan, meaning it was him, the mechitza, and then me. I think I was more connected to the davening. I could hear the davening. I was right next to him, more than most of the men sitting in the back. So in terms of a connection through Minyan, I think a lot of it depends on location, where you're sitting. You know, don't sit in the back, or find a shul that has a mechitza that goes the way that you want it to go. In terms of women's tefillah groups, To be honest, it was never something that attracted me or I felt a need for in any way. But I certainly did have friends who did. And as far as I understand, is that if you do it in a halachic way, then you really strip it down to a normal davening that you could do at home mainly, just doing with a large group of women. Now, to some extent, there is beauty in that, and some women completely connect to having a woman's tefillah group. I personally, for example, when I have been in the past invited to, a number of times, Baron Unite Shabbaton, and they kick the men out and they send them to shul, and the women go upstairs on the seventh floor in the base manager to the other building, and we do all the Shabbos together, and they sing. It's extremely beautiful, and I think it's a very inspiring experience for everyone. On the other hand, you should also realize that now there's this new thing coming up in the Orthodox world that women are doing called the Amen ceremony. It's kind of like the from women's prayer group, where women are getting together to say brachot together and say amen as many times as they can, bischus someone, you know, someone's health or something that's going on in someone's life. And I think to that extent, these are very positive ways that women are being able to get together and to express themselves, you know, in terms of their tefillah. It happens to be that the reason why I was never so pro women's tefillah group and why I never chose to go is because if I have the opportunity to go out of my home to daven, why would I choose a place where I can't say I can't hear Kaddish, I can't say, you know, hear Kaddish and Tush, I can't hear the laning? Why would I not go somewhere where I could daven b'tzibur and get a mitzvah for daven b'tzibur? Which is why, to me, it was never really a question. It was really going to Minyan and making sure that within my shul I can find a connection to the shul itself. And I think if the question that we're talking about here is, how do I have kavana in my tefillah? Well, I don't necessarily think, which I think was mentioned before, that davening in a minyan and being part of a minyan is the answer to that question. Because if that's true, then if you looked across the mechitza, every man should be davening be kavana, and every woman should be kind of lost because they can't be involved in the prayer. And that's not true. There are lots of men who are talking and not focused and don't have kavana. So at the end of the day, kavana is really about connecting to the words, which is hard for everyone because you're saying the same thing every single day, and yet you have to put new meaning in every day, and there's no easy answer. It's not like if I went to a woman's tefillah group, all of a sudden I'd be able to have kavana where I wouldn't have it before. I think sometimes we look for easy answers, but those aren't the answers. Having kavana is really a struggle for every person, whether they are the shaliach tzibur, or they're a man, or they're a woman, the struggle is the same. I think within the shul, and having a connection to your shul, a woman does have a voice in a lot of ways within a shul. You can give a shiur in your shul, and many shuls will allow a woman to give a shiur even in front of men. There are certain shuls who let the woman even give a sermon. There are shuls where you can be on the board, you can be on the sisterhood. You can have a voice within your own shul without having to pull away from the shul and create a woman's tefillah group. So at the end of the day, I think my big message to you is, think about, in terms of tefillah that you have, how am I going to make sure that tefillah means something to me, that in 10 years from now, when it's challenging because I have so many other things going on in my life, I'm still going to daven. I think that's the biggest challenge for women. How am I going to connect to my tefillah so that I don't stop davening?
Question number two. The language surrounding the legalities of marriage, which often liken women to an item claimed by contract, a woman's legal status as property of either her father or her spouse, are precepts which hardly reflect the independent lives women lead today. How can we come to terms with these references? How can we ensure and encourage women to be legally protected, especially in regards to divorce proceedings and prevention of more abuna crises?
Start here and then you know that way.
Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he talks about issues of feminism, and he mentions in there that in a marriage, both husbands and wives have responsibility towards each other to honor and respect and listen to each one. Now, it is true, there's no question, that if you look at the Talmudic model of marriage, so to speak, clearly, the husband is, let's say, quote unquote, the boss. Right? He is the one who who's supposed to be involved with the finances. He is the one who has right to his wife's income, to the income of property that she brings in, and to her income as well. But on the other side, the flip side of that is he also has obligations, that he has the responsibility of providing for the economic well-being of the marriage. But it's important to note that this really is subject to the mutual consent of both parties, because a woman has a right to say, "Eini nizonis ve'eini osa," I don't want to be supported by you, and I don't want to give you my earnings. A woman has a right to an independent economic arrangement in a marriage if she so desires. So the Gemara is giving you what was the default position, because again, that was probably the best scenario in those days for the well-being of the family, as well as for women themselves who didn't have the opportunity to earn that much, generally speaking, in the world at large. Also, of course, the Ksuva, which we know protects women's rights to a great extent, and was a groundbreaking document in its time that really did a tremendous amount. It's interesting to note also that most people in the Ashkenazi community, when we get married, we sign Tanoim at the Chassan's Tish. And the Tanoim is agreement signed by both fathers, really. And it states that Yishlatu b'nechseon shava b'shava, that the husband and wife will have equal say in their financial affairs. So already hundreds of years ago in Europe, this was recognized as that the model mentioned in the Gemara is not necessarily appropriate as economic times change. So this has changed over the years to a great extent. Of course, this doesn't have anything to do with the issue of gittin, where, as you know, right, only the husband is the one who has to give the get, the wife has to receive it. That's a halacha that's not really changeable, but we know that today to prevent, and the aguna problem is something which is, as it exists today, is due to the weakness of our communities, that we don't have effective measures to force recalcitrant spouses to give gittin. That's part of the unfortunate reality that we live in, that we don't have cohesive communities that can enforce anything. In the old days, you had a bezin in town. The bezin said the man had to give a get. He really had very little option because he had to follow what the bezin said in the town. You know that the prenuptial agreement is something which I cannot overemphasize, I cannot overemphasize the importance of signing such a thing before you get married. You have to sign a prenuptial agreement, and I think that affords it's not foolproof. By no means is it foolproof, but it certainly can go a great way to guaranteeing women's safety in terms of the agunah issue.
It's very hard when you're about to get married to talk about the issue of signing prenups and what those prenups really mean to you. I want to talk a little bit, although I am not a rabbi and I don't pretend to be and I'm not paskening anything, I do want to say something that I see halacha as evolving and changing. And just because we did something or wasn't done many years ago doesn't mean we can't relook at it and revisit and really push the envelope to make sure that women are not agunot, because it's a horrible, horrible situation. There are women waiting for many, many years. They cannot do anything about it. There are men who will not give a get unless a woman pays them for it. And very often, rabbis force the women, say, listen, you want it, you got to pay for it. It's not going to happen. Those are the conversations that rabbis have. Been there, know of a lot of friends of mine. So to me, this is very painful. To say that this is the way it is doesn't work. We need to fight, and the way we fight is we do sign those prenups so that it becomes a halacha as opposed to just a nice thing we do or don't do. But I urge you to study what that means, to think about it, to talk about it. You would never go and not have insurance. This is it. This is it. We all need to do it so that the community understands that this is what must be done. But study what it is. Learn it. Don't be afraid. It doesn't mean you're getting divorced. It means that you're just well-educated and know what it is. And unfortunately, we don't spend enough time on these issues before the fact. And many, many women are in deep trouble. So I say to all of you, let's fight together. If we do it together, the rabbis will listen. If we all get together and say, Ad Kan, we need to fight the issue. It's a very serious one.
In general, when we discuss marriage, a lot of times the wording that is being referred to here in the question is that we say a man is makne, a woman. There's a kinyan that's being made. And a lot of time, I think erroneously, people translate that to me. He's buying me. He's acquiring me. That's not really what the word means. Kaneh lecha chaver. You're not buying yourself a friend. You're not going on the street and buying someone to be your friend. You know, and a lot of times we have kinyanim between two people who are just making a contract with each other. They're not buying each other in any way. A lot of times what kinyan means is that you're legally binded to each other. There's a contract that is being made in between the two. Another lashon, though, that we should focus on even more is kiddushin. A man is mekadesh, a woman. He's supposed to be sanctifying in a woman. And I think that within a lot of the literature in the Gemara, this language and this understanding of how a man is supposed to sanctify his wife or protect his wife or cherish his wife is really very easy to be seen. The ksuva is really all about how a man can't just divorce his wife. In order for him to divorce her, he has to pay her a certain amount of money. That's why the halacha is that if a woman cannot find her ksuba, then relations becomes asur between the two of them. Because, as the Gemara says, it shouldn't be easy for him to just divorce his wife. It should be something that he has to think about. It's significant to him because it's going to cost him if he wants to divorce his wife. On top of that, as was being referred to before, the Pasuk in Shmos tells us that a man is required to give his wife Seirah, Suta, and Onata. You know, he's required to, you know, feed her, he's required to clothe her, give her shelter, and he's required, Onata, he's required to have relations with her. And as some of you know that have been in my classes where we discuss the mitzvah of Ona in a biblical sense, a man is required to make sure that a woman is satisfied sexually, not just with provisions of food and clothing, but is completely satisfied. And of course, on the flip side of that, there are many halachot restricting the man from doing anything that could harm his wife, certainly to rape his wife, but even more than that, even simple things like think about another woman while being with his wife. These are things that are usur on the man because the halacha is about protecting the woman. The halacha is about that we mean something. We're not a piece of property. You have to treat us well. That is something that's very important in a marriage. And I think within halacha, as Rabbi Alman was saying, is that yes, there is a model that's given, you know, within the sources, but there's no halacha that says the model has to be that way. There's no halacha that says the man has to be the boss of the house at all. And therefore, in today's society, I think we really have three different models of relationships. We have where the husband is the stronger personality and the woman is more the weaker personality. We have that the wife sometimes is the stronger personality and the boss of the house and the husband is not. And then we have the relationship of equals where the husband and wife equally together make decisions and run their home. And I think that halacha is telling us a marriage is not about one person owning the other or one person being the boss of the other. A marriage is about a relationship of two people who love each other, care about each other, and each do their part for the other person and cause this beautiful, I think, halachic relationship.
So I would like to make just two brief points. First, to just agree with pretty much everything that everybody had said, particularly the last point that Professor Price made about that it's vital to understand that kinyan does not mean purchase or acquisition of ownership, that kinyan is simply an expression, it's a rabbinic expression for entry into contract. The contract indeed needs to be mutual, and that women need to be much more conscious of the fact that when a husband under the chuppah says, Hareat mekudeshet libet habat zokat mushabi Yisrael, that he is not marrying her with that statement. He's offering marriage, and that the marriage is not effective until she actually accepts, willingly accepts the object which then manifests her acceptance of the offer of marriage. From my own perspective, it's, you know, I don't understand why women don't respond verbally, halachically. There's absolutely no objection to women responding verbally to the offer of marriage by indicating their acceptance of the offer of marriage, saying something like, which indicates that there is mutuality here, that there's an offer and an acceptance. It's not just he says some kind of magical words that create marriage. And I think that women have to be more conscious of everything that happens in the course of a wedding ceremony to make sure that the wedding ceremony itself gives expression to that sense of two independent parties entering into a mutual contract in which each party understands both their rights and their obligations and have arrived at agreement in regard to them. One final point in regard to the issue of the prenuptial agreement. I'll tell you what I tell, you know, my classes, and I told my daughters before they were dating and got married. I said it as simply as the following. I said, if you're interested in a man and, you know, and you're ready to get married and you start mentioning the use of a prenuptial agreement and he says, well, but my Rebbe told me, I should discuss that, my Rebbe told me that he really doesn't, you know, like the idea and he won't be Musab Kedushin if we use a prenuptial agreement, then you have to tell him, then let's find a different Musab Kedushin. And if the chassan says that, you know, he just won't do it, he won't you know, he thinks that it's inappropriate for people to make arrangements related to divorce at the time they're getting married, and so you won't sign a prenuptial agreement, then find a different chassan. Just find a different chassan. What I tell parents is that for parents to allow their daughters to marry without a prenuptial agreement is a form of child abuse. Parents should not allow it, and you have to not allow it. You have to not allow yourself to get married without the use of a prenuptial agreement.
We are greatly privileged to live in an age where women are more educated than ever. Will we hit the glass ceiling all too soon, or will the possibilities of Jewish women leadership continue to advance? How can we encourage communities to create or embrace these advanced leadership roles? What opportunities would you suggest, ritual, communal, or both? How would you implement them?
I live, I'm fortunate to live in a community and belong to a shul that has very strong women participation in almost every area. And I can tell you that I have benefited from a woman spiritual leader. So I want to share some personal experiences I've had, and perhaps they will resonate with you. So I'll go back many years. When I was in the hospital, I had just given birth. I had a C-section, and in walked a rabbi because he wanted to visit me. It wasn't the right time to come to visit me, but I understood. I mean, you know, I had a C-section. In those days, you stayed like 10 days in the hospital, and he wanted to come to visit me, and I understand that. But today, when I am in that need, there is a woman, a spiritual leader of our shul, who makes those visits to women. And it is the most comforting, and it is the most connectedness, and it just feels right. And I'll tell you the same thing when I was sitting Shiva. I'm back to that because that was very meaningful to me. My spiritual leader came to see me. She sat very close to me and talked to me, that no rabbi could ever do. We have opportunities. We have a lot of learned women today, women who want to be in that spiritual place, people who want to help other people to be guides in synagogue, to help in not only areas of health in that area, but also with smachot. So imagine that you're creating, or a baby girl is born, and there's a Simchat Bat, a Zevet Bat, and here's this woman who's sitting with you and actually helping you create either a ceremony or find tefillot that are meaningful, both women sitting. It's very comforting. It's really nice. It's also nice to come to a shul, and some people, you know, are new in a shul, and the spiritual leader walks over and says, welcome, would you like me to get you a sidur, a chumash, do you have a place to eat today? We have people we can fix you up with. It's a different experience. And I believe that there are women today who are willing and want to be part of that community. And to, together with the rabbi of the synagogue, create a community of more inclusive people together and as a community again, not 50% of the community, but both men and women working together towards a similar goal. And it's a model that I think that we could look at in the future, especially women who, again, are learned, and it's not only that they're teachers, but they know halacha, and they can talk to you about halachic issues that I think are much easier to talk to than with men, some sensitive issues. And I think we need to look towards that direction.
I think when it comes to women's education and the glass ceiling, which is what the question was about, I think we need to use a little bit of perspective. Which is, I think we have to realize that this glass ceiling has been moving at a pretty fast pace for the last number of years. take you back 11 years ago, when I was my first year, I'm going to be personal here, in the GPATS program, which is the Gemara and Halacha program, that is the graduate program upstairs in Stern in the other building. And I'll be honest with you, it was the second year of the program, and we were very controversial at the time, and there was a lot of flack that was being given. However, when I was in the program, my first year, I remember a very distinguished Rebbetzin coming over to me and saying, "What are you doing? You're never going to get married." I also had, same year, a rabbi from one of the yeshivas in Israel come over to me and say, "What are you doing? You're never going to get a job." Okay. I didn't blame them, because I think they were saying something very truthful at the time, which was, I certainly was making it difficult on myself to get married, though a year later I was married, but okay. You know, in terms of, there was a lot of boys who would not look at me because of the fact that I was sitting and learning Gemara and Halacha every day, Kilo sitting in Kola. However, to me, it was a good thing, because why should I waste my time on a guy that I clearly was never gonna marry anyway if he disagreed with what I was doing? But in terms of jobs, he was also right. At the time, I did not know of almost any woman that was teaching Gemara or Halacha anywhere. At the time, personally, I thought I was going to end up teaching Tanakh, because I didn't think that it was even going to be possible for me to ever teach Gemara and Halacha. Again, Marie Kamerfo will change that for me, as I do teach many of you Halacha and Tanakh. But I think that we have to take this perspective to understand that that was 10 years ago. And now, 10 years later, we have the GPATS program still remains. It's not so controversial as far as I know anymore. And those women are getting married. And there are many, many high schools that are having women teaching Gemara and Halacha. It's not just a man's world anymore. Even though I think I still am the only woman on the Justice Department here at Stern. But, you know, I think that it's starting to change in that direction. It's not unheard of anymore. But when I last year decided to hit another glass ceiling when I decided to sign up for the American Yoetzet program. For those who don't know, that's women who get educated to become experts in Hilchot Nida to help women in terms of their shiloh. This is a program that started around 10 years ago in Israel. It was very controversial then. And now in Israel, it is really a very common thing to have Yoetzot in almost all the communities. There's around 70, they say now, Yoetzot in Israel. And certainly there are certain communities that will not accept them, but they're very popular everywhere. I mean, their hotline and their website get thousands upon thousands of questions. Now, here in America, this is starting to change as well, because the first graduating class will hopefully graduate in a number of months. And then there will be a number of Yoetzot here in America. And hopefully, I hope that things will change in that area as well. What I've learned from being in the program is that when you want to change something, especially in the world of women's education, there's a number of things you have to keep in mind. Number one, you need to not have an agenda. Okay? The women that are chosen in this program clearly are women that don't want to make trouble. We just want to help people in terms of keeping Hilchot Nida and make lives for women easier. Number two, I think also in terms of the name that is chosen, a Yoetzet, in a lot of ways is in no competition to any other job that a man has, which I think to some extent is very helpful. But third, the Yoetzet program preaches over and over again that the way to change things is through patience. It takes time. Nothing changes in 5 minutes. Just because you think it should be accepted doesn't mean it will, but it also doesn't mean it won't. You just have to take time. It's years of women doing this with the right intention, helping women, that will hopefully enlighten other rabbis who were against it to not be so against it anymore and to see that there really is something very positive. But also, I just think we need to appreciate what is out there for us already. Women can give shiurim. Women in some communities, as you're saying, can be a spiritual leader or can give a sermon and things like that, which certainly is beginning. You know, women can now teach Gemara and Halacha in high schools, which we couldn't do before. So I think we have to have a perspective that the glass ceiling is moving. But then we have to question, where I disagree with you a little bit on what you said, I don't think there's that many women that are trying to get that ceiling moved. Meaning, I think a lot of us say it, oh, why can't women do this, why can't women do that? But then you're not actually going to try to do that. And therefore, in order to push a ceiling, you need someone actually pushing it in the other direction. I'll give an example. The other day, there was a Jewish high school, very good one, was looking for a Gemara teacher. And they wanted a woman. And I'll be honest, sadly, he's a great guy, they hired a man. Why? Because they couldn't find a woman who was capable of teaching that class that was applying for the job. So I think we also need to turn to ourselves within this question. Yes, we want women to be able to do everything, yeah, but there is a ceiling that when a limit that certainly women do have and women do hit. But I think that the possibilities for us are really, really huge. We have to appreciate the possibilities that we do have and what we can do in a halachic way, and we have to try to do that. We have to try to make Torah learning a priority and really, you know, push ourselves to do what is and appreciate what is already, possible for us to do.
So I had not intended to answer this particular question, but let me just add a couple of things. First of all, it seems to me that the most important thing, if you want to achieve the kinds of goals that have been spoken about before, is for everybody not to be selfish, something that, you know, men have not achieved in religious institutions, and religious institutions tend to be extraordinarily selfish in the sense that men's governance of religious institutions assumes that people should only be able to achieve their spiritual goals in the way in which the leaders of that particular institution think spiritual goals should be achieved. You have to not be that way. You have to recognize that even if there are spiritual goals, that if there are avenues toward the achievement of spiritual goals that you personally don't resonate with, but there are others who do resonate with them, you should fight to see to it that those pathways are open. Because you never know who needs what. The reality is that it's not just Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are Shivim Drachim, there are so many different pathways that lead people into a life of richness of Torah. And you have to fight to keep as many of those pathways open as possible. So I have never enjoyed being at a women's tefillah group, I must admit that. Sitting behind the mechitza in a women's tefillah group does not turn me on. And being only one of a maximum of 9 men at a tefillah is not part of my customary experience. At the same time, I have battled often and hard to see to it that women's tefillah groups can exist, because I think that there are women for whom that experience is extraordinarily important and extraordinarily rich. It opens up paths in terms of Limud Torah, it opens up paths in terms of Tefillah, it opens up paths in terms of their connection to a Tzibur that is open and welcoming for them. And it leads to all sorts of other things. And the fact that you may not, as an individual, enjoy it doesn't mean that you should not fight to see to it that pathway is accessible to those people who want it in the community. The same thing is true with regard to women spiritual leaders. The same thing is true with regard to Yatzot Halacha. The same thing is true with regard to women teaching Gemara. The same thing is true with the dozen of these pathways that are now being shaped that will ultimately transform the character of women's role, so to speak, within Orthodoxy and within Judaism, and that will ultimately transform our community for the better. Because when we begin to make use of 100% of the spiritual capacity for leadership in our community, we will be at least twice as strong, if not 10 times as strong, as when we're using only 50% or less than that of our capacity. One final point in this regard, there was a question of implementation, and there I would say as follows. If you were to really implement stuff in your local synagogue, for example, I would suggest that you start to talk to your husband eventually and to your friends about seeing to it that the only people who make decisions about contributions to synagogue are the women.
I think that pretty much everything has been said that has to be said on this. Maybe I'll just add a few more points anyway. So as was mentioned at the beginning, Professor Price was speaking about the OATSO program in the United States. I'm very involved in that program, and the reason that I think it's a very good thing is not because, again, I have any agenda for pushing women into positions of leadership. I think if it happens, it happens. It's wonderful. I don't have an agenda to think of it. It has to happen. If it'll happen, if it's good, it'll happen by itself. But my reason for being involved is because here I think that the idea is a good idea. It's very good to have women who can answer questions in Hilchot Nida, who understand it. Women will clearly be more comfortable speaking to women about these things than they are to men. Although there are plenty of people who call me with shilas and this who are comfortable speaking to me fine, but still, there'll be a greater comfort level speaking to women. If it'll increase the number of questions of Shailot that come, so that's a good thing. And I think that's the way we have to look at these things. Is it, so to speak, is it good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? If it's good for us, then we have to do it. Again, assuming it's within the parameters of halacha. So then we have to go for it and do it. Is it good that women are much more involved in learning Torah today than they were 50 years? Absolutely. So if it's good, we have to do it, and we have to promulgate it, and we have to push for these kind of things, because it's good for Klal Yisrael, it's good for Torah, it's good for Shmiras HaMitzvos. Where I would like to take issue a little bit, if you'll forgive me, Professor Dr. Gorsman, will you permit me to? Okay, you can respond if you want to.
I will.
Okay. I think we often make a mistake with confusing feeling good with doing mitzvot and with following the Torah. As one great Hasidisha Rebbe once said, and this is it's surprising coming from a Hasidisha Rebbe, but he said, some mitzvahs are like maror. They're not so pleasant, and you have to do them anyway, because ultimately we have to do the tzivuyim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the fact that you felt very good when a female spiritual advisor came to see you, that's very nice. But I don't know that has much to do with Judaism, other than the fact that there's a mitzvah in general to make people feel nice, the mitzvah of Gemilas Chasadim, to help people out, that's true. But feeling nice or feeling connected or feeling good is not in it. Again, I'm sounding too much like I'm a snagit. But,
No, I won't claim you.
No? Okay. So I have it on both sides. Right.
That's why they didn't seat us
right,
together.
So, you know, feeling good is very nice. You go to a concert. You love it. It's beautiful music. But it's not particularly religious. That has nothing to do with religion. That's very nice. There are many things in the world that make people feel good. But it's not what Torah is about. Sometimes Torah makes you feel good. Sometimes it doesn't. Our goal isn't we do this because we feel good. Our goal is we do it because it's a mitzvah. Because it's something we're mechuyev to do. And because it's the tzivuy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I don't like this whole idea of saying that things are positive because they make one feel good, I don't think is a good argument in terms of halacha and Torah. It may be nice, but that doesn't make it part of Judaism. So I know I probably just opened up a whole can of it, but
you did.
All right, Ed.
So the piece that felt good had nothing to do with mitzvah. There's no mitzvah on me to feel good or to do anything. Is that, I'm not sure what you're referring
to. No, you said,
to.
You, because you said.
I said right. That it was very comforting to have a woman sit near me when I was sitting Shiva and whispering in my ear some important words of perspective and things of that sort that no rabbi could ever come as close. And that made me feel good, and I was sitting Shiva, and that to me was a mitzvah that she did for me. So in that sense, it is a mitzvah. So you know what? We'll leave that. The other thing I want to say, everybody's been saying here, there's no agenda. I want to say something about agenda. Everyone has an agenda. It might not be the agenda that we all think together. But whatever we do, we have an agenda. Your agenda is to teach Torah. That's an agenda. Everyone has an agenda. So to put yourself back and you say, I don't have an agenda, that's a little disingenuous as far as I'm concerned, because we all have agendas. Some of us have agendas that other people don't like. Okay, we can live with that. But everyone has an agenda. If you teach Torah, you have an agenda. You have a derech to teach Torah, that's your agenda. the way I teach Torah could be my agenda. That's okay. Eilu ve'eilu. The other, I want to make one more point about this feeling good. I'm an educator. And I also know that when we feel good about something that we are learning or doing, it stays with us. When we're not feeling good, yeah, it can become rote, but it doesn't bring us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when we don't feel good about it. And my issue is that if I want a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's got to feel good. It doesn't mean every day is the same thing, but there has to be an element where I emotionally connect. And yes, I think emotional connection is critical to having a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the same way that emotional connection is critical to having a relationship with another human being. It's all part of the same thing. It's that Tzelem Elokim. And I do feel that feeling good about something, either a mitzvah or otherwise, will repeat itself again and again.
Question number four. I'll tell you that we have two more questions to get to, so at the end, if you want to go ahead, I just don't want to keep anyone in the captive audience. Question number four. In the lack of obligation to time-bound or positive commandments, many women are left feeling disenfranchised and unattached to their Judaism. Similarly, many wonder if their avoda is boiled down to motherhood. How would you respond to such claims? Would you encourage a change in education of women which encourages rigor of practice despite the lack of obligation? How would you suggest implementing this?
Okay. I think to answer this question, I want to actually destroy the question. First of all, in the first line of the question, time bound positive commandments, not or, right? We are only not commanded in time bound positive commandments, which really are around 12, 13, 14. Thank you, Rabbi Gurman. 14 mitzvahs. Okay, so we have 613 mitzvahs. Not that everybody can do every mitzvah, but okay, a few hundred. And we are not commanded 14. Now, if you are Ashkenaz, then you are allowed to do all these mitzvahs. You get a mitzvah for doing these mitzvahs. You just are not commanded necessarily that you have to do these mitzvahs. Now, I know people say it's apologetic, but it is not. Once you are a mother and you are dealing with a baby or numerous babies, some of those specific mitzvahs are very hard to do. And when you're in that position, you say, thank you for not making me obligated in that mitzvah. You don't say, oh no, they don't think I'm good enough or I'm only about being a mommy because I'm not obligated. No, they're saying, being a mommy is good, it's a priority, it's a good thing, so let's help you out a little bit and take away some of the guilt you might feel when you're not able to do certain mitzvahs. On top of that, the assumption of that all my avoda is boiled down to motherhood. But let me say this. I am a very proud mother of three children. And no matter how much Torah I teach, no matter how much Torah I learn, how many learning programs I go to, my number one priority in my life is my children and my family. And I say that with every ounce of my being. There is nothing like having a child. There is nothing like loving a child. That doesn't mean I can't be who I want to be or I can't accomplish what I want to accomplish. Halacha's not stopping me from that. Halacha values family. Halacha requires families to be produced. But Halacha doesn't tell me how many hours a day I have to spend with my children versus how many hours I can go do something else. Halacha allows me the window to decide whatever I want. So women who fall in love with their children, which is hopefully every single woman, who wants to spend and see every last second of their lives, there are some women, therefore, who decide that they're going to be full-time mothers and they stay home, and hooray for them. I think sometimes we look at these, oh, you're only a stay-at-home mom, really? Really? Amazing. amazing. You're a stay-at-home mom. You're amazing. That's great. But there are some women who say, as I personally would say about myself, I'll go crazy, and then I won't be the productive mother that I would like to be, and therefore I need to be productive and develop myself as well. And therefore, I chose personally to go for a career and a job, where first of all, I like learning, so that's where I went for teaching Torah. But I went for a career and a job that would mean that I could balance my family life and my family priorities with my job in a way that I felt comfortable. There are some people who are going to go for full-time careers, and their balancing of their lives is going to be different. Halacha doesn't say you can't have a full-time career. Of course you can. You can be whoever you want to be. You know, your husband wants to be a stay-at-home mom. Great. You want to hire a babysitter? Fantastic. You need to do what you feel comfortable doing in your life, and Halacha's not saying anything about it. Halacha's not saying you can only be a mother. Halacha's saying, yay, you get to be a mother. That's amazing. And I think that this is something that I have found a lot of times in a lot of people that I speak to later in life, they don't think about when they're in your position, when they're in college. When you're in college and you're picking a career, okay, besides the fact that you have to think about what you enjoy and what you don't enjoy, you must think about what type of mother you want to be. Meaning, if you put yourself in a career that is a full-time career, okay, now some women, that is great, and that's what they want for their life. But I know a lot of women who did that, they didn't think about it, and then later in life they went, oh my gosh, I gotta quit my job because I can't balance the two worlds, and now they regret that decision. Or the opposite. Women who, when they were in college, were like, I don't really need to look into a career, I don't really need to figure out, go into a good graduate school or whatever, because I'm gonna be a mom and that's gonna be the priority of my life. And then later they regret that they didn't set themselves up to be who they wanted to be. And there's a dream there that they never got to fulfill. So I don't think in any way your avoda boils down to motherhood. I think your avoda is motherhood, awesome, amazing. You know, I'll give a story from the Shabbat. I was sitting down to read an article on the couch, a halacha article, on something that was a question asked in one of my classes here, so I apologize, I didn't read the article. But my two daughters came over to me and said, do you want to play? And I spent 2 hours, and I'm not joking, playing Duck Duck Goose, you know, Red Light, Green Light, What Time Is It, Mr. Fox? And then they gave me a hairdo, which was quite fantastic, and I got fake manicure and pedicure. And that was 2 hours of my Shabbos afternoon. Let me tell you, it was an awesome 2 hours of my Shabbos afternoon. So when you choose your career path, you have to think about this, not because halacha is telling you one way or the other. You need to choose what you want. When you choose a spouse, you need to do the same. You need to have a spouse that is going to push you in the direction that you want to be and support you in what you want to do and everything in your goals in life, because that's how you can have your career, your motherhood, and define yourself by both, not by one.
Okay. Two quick points. First of all of you should take enormous pride, really just enormous pride, in the assertive engagement of women today in the contemporary Orthodox community, in virtually almost all of the mitzvot from which they are pturot. When I was a kid, the only mitzvah from which nashim were pturot that they regularly did was hearing tkiyat shofar. Women did not sit in the sukkah, and they didn't count sfirat ha'omer, and they never took an esrog and lulav except for some old ladies to his house who, you know, brought them occasionally. But, you know, it was not part of the standard expectation. You are living now in a world in which, other than tefillin and maybe tzitzit, all of the other mitzvot are really a stable part of the conduct of Orthodox women. Recitation of Kriyat Shema, counting the Omer, sitting in a sukkah, taking etrog and lulav, hearing shofar, Talmud Torah, right? The study, intensive study of Torah. There are women today, Orthodox women, who are morlot, right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe designated, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, designated in the Soviet Union, in Moscow, designated a woman physician as the person who would do Brit Milah for the Chabad community in Moscow 20 years ago, 25 years ago, right? It's like women buy the right to have a letter written in a Sefer Torah for themselves, so they should be zochet to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Ketivat Sefer Torah. Right? I mean, it's a different world today. And you need to take enormous pride in that, because what you and your generation are doing is demonstrating that pater shmater, these are actions that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has designed for our enrichment, for the enrichment of our spiritual and intellectual lives. And we want that enrichment. What an extraordinary statement to be making, and you have to take pride in that and make sure that you're party to that and that you encourage it for yourselves and for others. One other point. What Professor Price said, I would like to add one aspect to, and that is that it is not only for mothers that the raising of children needs to be their first priority. You have to be able to contribute to a world in which the mitzvah of parenthood, in which the sense of avodas Hashem that is present in parenthood is appreciated by both mothers and fathers. Because the reality is that parenthood is an extraordinary, an absolutely extraordinary opportunity for avodas Hashem in a way that virtually no other mitzvah can allow for. Don't let men off the hook in regard to both parental responsibilities and parental spiritual opportunities.
Shkalach, I agree with everything that was said on this, so I don't have anything more to add. Very good.
Of course I do. I've lived a long life, Baruch Hashem, and Bezlat Hashem will continue to. But I want to tell you about my personal experience in my life and about women and how, thank God, we get to live long lives these days, so that there are different parts of our lives where we could sort of plug in to different things in our spirituality and our Judaism. And I want to tell you that when I had young children, it was really hard for me to go to shul. And as much as I love to daven, I love to daven, it was hard, it was a struggle. Some of my children couldn't sit in shul, it wasn't for them. So lots of things can happen, you know. We need to create those things when it doesn't happen and you want it, and that's where you want to be. Well, you know, there are early minyanim that you can share with your spouse, either you go or he goes or whatever it is. But the other piece is that there is life after children. And that life takes on other responsibilities, other obligations in terms of looking at yourself and possibilities in terms of spirituality. And I can tell you that when my children were growing up and, you know, sort of college age and things of that sort, my tefillah took on a totally different approach, and also my participation in terms of learning and my participation in terms of learning more about tefillah and studying about tefillah and getting deeper into it. So again, it's not one size fits all. It's different stages of our lives. We can do different things and have wonderful possibilities, obligations, etc. And I do agree that, got my doctorate, did it all, but guess what? Not when I was 21, not when I was 25, not even when I was 30. I did have my children, I stayed home with my children, I did work a little bit, part-time, so there are different ways to do it. Not everybody does it the same way, but you need to think about your life in the long term, not just this minute, what's happening. God, am I only a mother?
Yep. We're going to open it up to questions.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is addressed to Rabbi Amen.
You said earlier that if it's good for the Jews, it should happen. I gave the examples of Yotzot Halacha and learning and all that. My question is, who decides what's good for the Jews? In other words, if one person benefits from having, let's say, a female spiritual guide, is that enough to constitute the whole? And if not, who decides what the whole is and who decides what's good for the Jews? And secondly, you said later on that feeling nice is different from mitzvot. But my question is, if feeling nice is good for the Jews, then why shouldn't it be considered important to promote as well?
Let me take the second part first, and then I'll see if I can answer the first part. I'm not sure I can, but feeling good, when I said if it's good for the Jews, I mean from the perspective of advancing Torah and mitzvahs. Because I have a very narrow-minded way of looking at things in the world. If it's a mitzvah, if it's something which promotes the goals of Torah as we've received it, then it's good for the Jews. Making me feel good is right. It's nice to do chesed for someone. You always should make other people feel good. No question. We want people to feel good. 100%. I'm not a masochist, and I'm not a sadist. And I don't want anybody not to feel good. 100%. We should feel good. But we often make a mistake of confusing a feeling of feeling good with a religious experience. And the two are not necessarily the same. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. And so that's the point that I made about feeling good. Now, in terms of the other question of who determines what's good for the Jews, that's a very, very tough question. Obviously, there has to be some consensus amongst a feeling that whatever is being done is not violating any halachic norms. So that would be the very basic step, because if it's violating halachic norms, then it can't be good for the Jews. And no matter how good it'll make us feel, right? If it's going to do something against halacha. So the first step would be, is something violating halacha or not? You can take a number of issues across the spectrum. So for example, I would argue that, let's say, within our circles, learning Torah, women learning Torah is a good thing. We perceive it as not violating any halachic norms, and that's why we promote it. Those Jews who are, again, I'm just using the district, let's say the Hasidic community or whatever, who don't advocate women learning Torah, I don't think that they are doing it because they want to be mean to women. I think that they have just a very different perspective on what halacha permits and doesn't permit, and therefore they feel that this is not permissible, so even though it may have other good results, we can't allow it because it violates halacha. Now, that's probably the way. So, look, I don't agree with them, and you're going to always have differences of opinion as to what's good for the Jews and what is violating halachic norms and what is not, but within every community there has to be some consensus as to what it is. Part of that will be halachic considerations. If there are no negative reasons why not to do something, then you have to discuss, from a public policy point of view, is it a good idea or is it not a good idea? And again, that's part of the same issue. So there's not one person who does it. I think it's a consensus of Rabbanim. I do take a little bit of issue, since I have the mic, I'm going to use this to argue with my good friend over here. That I don't know trying to pressure rabbis to agree that something should be changed, like with regard, I understand why you would feel that way in terms of, let's say, the aguna issue, which is a terrible look. But on the other hand, no rabbi wants women to be agunos, to be an aguna. Why would any rabbi want that? I mean, if anything, it only brings heartache to everyone. It's a terrible thing. It reflects badly on everyone. It reflects badly on halacha. It reflects, it only makes tzaros. No rabbi wants women to be agunas, to be an aguna. Rabbanim just sometimes feel that there's nothing they can do about it. So if a rabbi does tell a woman, which again I don't necessarily agree with, but if a rabbi does tell a woman, look, you better pay or you'll never get this guy, he may just be advising her, thinks is best for her in the long run. Now, it's terrible that we have, but that has to be the choice. I agree, it ought not be the choice. But if you're telling me that let's say the only way I could, if I have a terrible illness, I have to pay $500,000 to find a cure, you may do it. Now again, I agree it's wrong. It's 100% wrong, but a rabbi who gives that advice is not doing it because he hates the woman, or he just feels under these circumstances he can't see any way out. There are some women in our community there's a woman who's an aguna for now 15 years. 15 years she's suffering, this woman. We threw, the husband was thrown out of shul, no question, immediately. Thrown out. He's an elderly man by now already. I just went to see him. I figured I have to try one more time. I have to do something for this woman. I said to him, so-and-so, do you want your death to be the cause of other people's rejoicing? Is that what you want? That when you're going to die, people are going to be happy? Didn't move him. Didn't move. So sometimes you have situations where you just can't do anything. You absolutely can't. It kills me. It takes out my kishrus. What am I supposed to do?
I would like to just sort of respond to bits and pieces. First of all, in terms of who decides, we have a well-established, really well-established procedure for how we arrive at such decisions. We fight for about a century. And by the time we're finished fighting, everybody is so exhausted, we're dead, that there's no fight anymore, and so that's what we decide to do. Right? That's very simple. We do that all the time. At the same time, it seems to me that you do have to take the position that not everything that you think is right would be agreed to by Rabbanim. I mean, I hate to say it, I have colleagues who are, you know, with whom I learned as a young man in Yeshiva Terev Das, who are now Rabbanim in various communities in the United States and in various other places, to whom women remaining at the note is simply part of the nature of things. You know, it's a gate zayon, but not a lot. Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, that's the Matthias. I mean, that is my experience, right? My experience is that there are people out there who are not at all distressed by the fact that there are some women who are of the note. In fact, like most colonized people, who tend to accept the values that are imposed upon them from outside and then rationalize them, they say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it that way. So I'm not saying that Chas V'Shalom, she did anything to deserve it, but maybe she's a Gilgul of the Neshama that requires this tzar in order to be redeemed. And therefore, you know, it's not my job to relieve her if the halacha does not allow me to relieve her. And the consequence of that is that, yeah, I think that people need to be pushed. If people were not pushed, we would not have the prenuptial agreement. The prenuptial agreement did not emerge out of the woodwork, and it didn't emerge out of, you know, the mind of one great person. It emerged out of the intense battle that took place from 1955 until 1990. You know what that means? From 1955 until 1990, the first proposal for prenuptial agreement was made in 1990. There were antecedents to that also, but the first serious proposal here in the United States, 1955 till 1990, before there was an agreed upon document that could be utilized. If you don't actively engage with these kinds of issues, then no changes will not happen.
I think we're all out of time. Are there any burning questions? I mean, there are several, but okay, we're taking this one last question.
Sure.
One more.
Hi. Sorry, I was going to stand up. I can't see you. This is addressed to Professor Room.
What's your name?
Shira. Hi. There's two things that you said that I just would appreciate clarification. Sure. Number one is the question that was posed that you answered was like, how do you feel about like the woman's role right now in the Jewish community and like about the glass ceiling? And I'm paraphrasing, but. So you answered that with your personal experience about having a spiritual woman mentor, whatever. So I'm curious, I'm listening to you speak, and I'm curious how that's different. It's one thing if we're discussing women rabbis, but we're not. Like, you weren't saying that, you were saying a woman spiritual mentor, so how is that different than, like, the Rebbetzin? Meaning, again, it's not called a Rebbetzin, everyone thinks a Rebbetzin is like...
I'll tell you one way. Number one, she's formally educated. Number one, she's formally educated in halacha. She's also spent
about 10 years learning. And the other piece is she gets paid for her job. What a concept. A woman who does the job gets paid for it. She's also a ritual member of the rabbinical staff. So she gets to discuss in meetings, and your voice as a woman is represented there. So there's a real leadership in the shul itself, representing women, by women.
Thank you so much to our speakers. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone on the Women's Studies Society who pitched in tonight, and thank you all for coming. Okay, so you'll just get free once you've gone.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I have a question. You said that you like say
most men get it. Depends on the shul. In my shul, it was permitted.
Even if the only person saying kaddish. Thank you so much for
having me.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. I wanted to thank you for your last point. I've heard the other approaches. It's not the having a woman spiritual leader is something that resonates with me, because I've always had teachers who are very educated and didn't feel the need for your last point that they sit on the board, you know what I mean, we're at meetings. That I've never heard that, and that makes sense. But yeah. No, thank you. Yeah.
They're not telling you what to do because we decided that's a board meeting.
Right. Yeah. No, that's it. I hadn't been exposed to before. Thank you.
No. But it, yeah. Nice. That's your name.